All right. So first, a brief overview of the history of, well, pulsars and globular clusters, which really, almost without exception, but some important exceptions, means the history of millisecond pulsars in globular clusters. The first millisecond pulsar was discovered in the disk of the galaxy by Don Becker, Sri Kulkarni, and collaborators 20 years ago. And then people pointed out that one way of producing these objects was by what is still pretty much the standard model, recycling, where you have a companion star that leaves the main sequence and starts transferring mass and angular momentum to a slow old pulsar or neutron star, spins it up in a low mass X-ray binary phase. And if this was true, then given the high incidence of low mass X-ray binaries in globular clusters, people suggested this should be a good place to search for millisecond pulsars. And after a few years, in fact, the first one was found in M28, and then many more discoveries followed. Then there was a lull in the mid-90s, and recently lots of us have been finding more pulsars in globular clusters. So what are some of the questions that I'll touch upon, if not answer, today by giving an overview from the point of view of Parkes, what we've been doing down there? Well, you would like to know what kind of pulsars, what kind of binary systems form in globular clusters. How are these pulsars distributed radially in the globular clusters? That presumably tells us something about the dynamics, also maybe formation. And in particular, a big question, which is really, really hard to answer conclusively, but is what kind of clusters have pulsars and roughly how many pulsars exist in each cluster? There are many selection effects apart from the obvious ones like distance. Pulsars are weak, millisecond pulsars are weak radio sources. Normally in the disk of the galaxy we find them within 2 or 3 kiloparsecs in the disk. But of course, globular clusters in general tend to be further away, so right there you tend to have a sort of order of magnitude drop in flux, which means 2 orders of magnitude in integration time if you want to reach same luminosity limits, and that's a big problem, reducing all those data and so forth. Then there are also propagation effects through the interstellar medium, this dispersion measure, the integrated column density of electrons, free electrons between us and the pulsar, which makes it quite difficult to find pulsars that are either it's a further difficulty for finding pulsars that are either further far away or short period pulsars. Scintillation, pulsars, they twinkle in the interstellar medium, which can be a good thing. It helps us finding intrinsically very weak pulsars. So that's actually a good thing sometimes. And finally, processing of these very long integration times. If you're trying to find a binary pulsar in a half-hour orbit and your integration time is 2 hours, obviously the period is going to change during your integration. You can't just do a straight FFT to try to find a fixed period. And that's very, very computationally expensive. So these are some of the problems that we always have to consider. So now I'll give you an overview of some results from 47 TUC, which is the cluster for in which the largest number of pulsars are known. And then, so this will maybe tell you some of the things that in principle we might be able to do with most clusters if you find enough pulsars there and can study them well enough. And then in the second half, I will give you an overview of searches that we've been doing recently in other clusters at Parkes. So here's 47 TUC, 5 kiloparsecs away, and 22 millisecond pulsars are known there. Half of those were found a decade ago, and the other half within the past few years, more recent different searches. The thing I want to point out here in this picture on the left is that this is a, and never mind all the curves, just consider the orange one, the one that I've highlighted with orange. That's the sensitivity curve for our searches as a function of pulsar period. And the dots with error bars are the average fluxes of several pulsars that we found in the cluster. And what you see is that only 2 of these pulsars are actually above the threshold sensitivity. All of the others, we've only found them when due to interstellar scintillation, so that when they were focused and when the apparent flux on the day was much, much higher than the average flux. So most of the time, we just don't see those pulsars. And this sort of effect, of course, can happen in many clusters, especially the ones that are relatively nearby or that have low dispersion measures, such as 47 TUC. And that, of course, you have to take into account when trying to consider the intrinsic population of pulsars. We are doing other searches, more sensitive searches. Faster sampling makes us more sensitive to the really short period pulsars below 1 millisecond, but that's still ongoing. We haven't reduced those data properly. On the right, you see the luminosity distribution for the pulsars in 47 TUC. And it matches within the luminosity range that we are sensitive to, it matches the luminosity distribution of pulsars in the disk of the galaxy in M15 and so on. And the idea, I estimated in the past how many pulsars we might be able to see in 47 Tuck, and I came up with this number of 200. But that's just, it's just assuming that the minimum luminosity limit is in fact similar to the pulsars in the disk of the galaxy, and that this luminosity distribution continues down to that low luminosity. But that's a big assumption. It's not unreasonable, it's still a big assumption. So you may want to take that with a grain of salt. And then from Chandra data that Josh will talk about tomorrow, maybe we can estimate that there may be up to about 100 neutron stars there or so. Anyhow, I just wanted to point out that this business of figuring out radial luminosities and luminosity distributions in clusters, together with Chandra data, may give us a handle on for estimating luminosity, total number of pulsars, total number of neutron stars in some globular clusters. So then you can time these pulsars, as we say, try to find their positions very accurately with a sort of accuracy of 10 milliarc seconds. And what you find for 17 pulsars in 47 Tuck, for which we have these positions, is that they are all within 1.2 arc minutes from the center of the cluster, which is surprising in some sense, even if you think nothing about theory or about what you might have expected. It's just that we found these pulsars with a beam, a telescope beam, has an area that's 100 times larger than this tiny area at the center of the cluster. And all of them are in that central 1% area. Then here's the actual distribution, cumulative radial distribution, and the deprojected spatial density that is suggested by this distribution is something like 1 over r squared up to 3 core radii, and then there are no more pulsars found beyond 3 core radii. That's not the case for the Chandra sources, and again, Josh will talk about that. So is this as expected? Well, it's different, for instance, from what you see in M15, where the distribution is something like 1 over r cubed, and the dominant species there, it's presumably massive white dwarfs. So what does this imply for what's going on at the center of 47 Tuck? Well, I don't know. Fred has big issues with this distribution. He thinks this it's not well understood. That may be the case. Is this in isothermal equilibrium? Does it suggest that the dominant mass species at the center is something like 1.5 solar masses, which, even if it is so, need not be neutron stars, I guess. You also have blue stragglers and other things. But so that's a question, but that's something that hopefully this can inform. So that's radial distribution. Now, let me, still while considering 47 Tuck, give an overview of the spin and orbital period distributions for pulsars in globular clusters in general. And there it is at the top, histogram. You see the distribution of the pulses in 47 Tuck. They're all millisecond pulses with a very narrow distribution. And even though we're sensitive down to periods of about a millisecond, we certainly don't see any below 2 milliseconds. And Lars has pointed this out, and perhaps it suggests that for whatever reason, well, either pulsars don't form with periods below a couple of milliseconds, perhaps because the accretion systems that you have just do not allow you to form those systems, or perhaps due to R modes or some other method of just radiating away, radiating gravitational waves, you just cannot keep pulsars spun up to sort of periods below 1.5 or so milliseconds. And that may be the case, but again, we're reducing these data, these higher resolution data that we have, so within the next year or so, we should have a better answer to that. And then there's a few exceptions to the, most pulsars are millisecond pulsars. There's a few important exceptions, but I won't go into that now. Here is the orbital period distribution, and basically what you have is you have, of course, you have isolated pulsars as well, but you basically have 0.03 solar mass white dwarfs, in quotes. These are strange systems. Often the radio pulses are eclipsed in these systems. And then you have many presumed helium white dwarfs in the 0.2, 0.3 solar mass range. Peter Edmonds mentioned one particular one in 47 Tuck yesterday. Just considering here the pulses in 47 Tuck, a third of them are isolated. A third of them have these helium white dwarfs, what we think are helium white dwarfs. And then a third of them are these very, very low mass type systems. Again, there's a couple of exceptions. And now, and by the way, these helium white dwarf systems have eccentricities of about 10 to the minus 4, which may seem small, but it's actually quite large compared to the equivalent systems in the disk of the galaxy. So this is presumably a fossil remnant of interactions of these binary systems in the dense cores of clusters, in this particular case of 47 Talk. So now I'll just very briefly mention one exception to this. Just like I said, pulses in 47 Talk, a third isolated, a third helium white dwarfs, a third these very, very low mass systems. There are one or two exceptions. This is one called 47 Talk W. It has a main sequence companion, and basically I won't go into these details because I don't have time, but Peter Edmonds and Craig Heinke did excellent work with Chandra data, HST data, Chandra data, together with the radio data. And this is a pulsar for which we don't have a timing position, which we normally do from radio observations. And yet what we found is that this beautiful light curve, and you do an FFT on it, basically, and you have the same exact binary period. Oh, I'm sorry. So you have the same binary period in the optical data as in the radio data, to within 0.5 seconds. This is a 3-hour binary. And the phases match, and basically this is the companion to 47 Talk W, and it's a main sequence star, a light main sequence star. And that's an exception. That's very unusual. That's the first sort of companion like that in 2-millisecond pulsar. And finally, for 47 Talk, you can also learn about the intercluster medium, and I definitely won't go into the details here because I don't have time. But basically, we believe that we have found evidence for a density, a free electron density in the cluster center of about 0.07 electrons per cubic centimeter. And that's not much mass at all. It's less mass than you would expect to accumulate between passages through the disk of the galaxy. But perhaps, well, something so is expelling most of the gas, and the millisecond pulses themselves, which enable us to detect this gas, are probably responsible for ejecting this gas somehow. And we can also learn something about the mass distribution at the center of the cluster. We have this mass-to-light ratio within an annulus of 12 arc seconds in size at the center of the cluster. So this mass-to-light ratio is greater than 1.4 solar masses per solar luminosity. I won't go into proper motions, which are also another interesting thing. All right, so now I'll have to mention other park searches, recent searches. We have searched about 60 globular clusters with expected dispersion measures below 300 parsecs per cubic centimeter. We have processed about 3/4 of these without uniform acceleration searches so far, so that's ongoing. It's still a very hard problem to do computationally. And these are the pulsars discovered in 6 of the clusters. Andrea Pocenti on Friday will discuss this first cluster in detail. So now I'll try to highlight some of the results from the other clusters. So because time is relatively short, and there is a poster outside on this pulsar. This is a pulsar in NGC 6397. It's a very interesting pulsar. Again, it has an unusual companion. It's not the standard helium white dwarf or very, very low mass companion. It displays eclipses and variable dispersive delays at all orbital phases. That's very strange. It's a 1.3-day binary system, 3-millisecond pulsar. And basically, there's a lot of data on this, both with Chandra, HST, and it shows, the one thing to mention about this pulsar is that it's been ejected from the core of the cluster. It's at 11 core radii away from the center. So that's quite unusual. Presumably, it was ejected when it acquired the present companion. That's not really known. So like I said, there's a poster by Elena Sabi outside. You can find all these details. VLT data that we've gotten recently that has enabled us to get the mass ratio of the system. There it is. It's this pulsar labeled A at the top. So it's a very red system, perhaps like these red stragglers that I believe Raja yesterday mentioned in 47 Talk. And one of the unusual things here in the system is that the E dot, the spin-down luminosity of the pulsar, is something like 20 times the bolometric luminosity of the companion. So you might have expected larger variations in the optical light curve that are seen. So it's not totally clear what's going on there. But we have detected some helium-1 absorption here. this suggests that there's some heating. So there's some regions of the star that are very hot, and perhaps it suggests an isotropic pulsar wind. But the interpretation of that is still ongoing. So very quickly about some highlights, as it were, of the other pulsars in the other clusters that we have found. 6752, like I said, one interesting thing there is that there are many single pulsars and one binary, but single pulsars are easier to find than binary ones, so perhaps that's not a big problem. There is an odd radial distribution to the pulsars, and perhaps Andrea will mention that tomorrow. These pulsars scintillate a lot, so it's easy to find intrinsically weak pulsars, which has been good for us. Compare that to 6266, where we have found three pulsars, and then Brian Jacoby, that we'll talk later this morning, at the Green Band Telescope, has found another three pulsars, and they're all binaries. So why so many binaries? Like I said, it's much easier to find single pulsars than binaries, and yet all of them so far are binaries. So that's, I think, a little surprising. And at least the three pulsars we have found at Parkes are very near, concentrated near the core. So again, that's different than the situation in 6752. So there's not much scintillation in this cluster, it's further away. But for any reasonable luminosity distribution, I was thinking about this the other day, and I convinced myself that there must be lots of millisecond pulses in this particular cluster, something perhaps like 47 tuck. I mean, I'm not saying the same exact number, but lots of them. And yesterday, I enjoyed very much seeing the excellent talk by Dave Pooley, where he showed those beautiful images and showed that, in fact, in 6266, there's tons of apparent, well, possible, I suppose, neutron stars, a lot of sources observed with Chandra. So that was really good. And then these two other clusters, not much to say. I don't want to go into detail about these two. We only have one pulsar so far in each. In each case, the luminosity of those pulsars are relatively large. So, of course, we find the stronger pulsars first. But they're large in an absolute sense, if you consider the pulsar luminosity distribution for millisecond pulsars in general. So this suggests that in all of these cases, we are just probing the tip of the iceberg. There could be lots of other weaker pulsars in all of these clusters. Since I only have a couple minutes left, I will bypass this transparency, show you this interesting example of an unusual eccentric binary in NGC 6441. The companion mass is greater than 0.6 solar masses with an eccentricity of 0.7, so this could be a double neutron star binary, and we should be able to measure the relativistic advance of periastron within the coming months, and then that will tell us more about the total mass of the system. So that's quite interesting, this system, very unusual. And I will conclude with two transparencies about, again, more global properties of the distribution of pulsars in globular clusters. Here's a radial distribution for all pulsars known in globular clusters, for which a position is actually known. There's about 70 pulsars now known in 22 globular clusters. And what you see here is that the vast majority of pulsars are located within 0.2 to 5 core radii. There are a very few exceptions. This one in GC6397 I mentioned earlier, which was ejected presumably when it acquired its present unusual companion. One in M15C, which is a double neutron star binary. Again, it was ejected. And two in 6752, which Andrea may speak about tomorrow. But in general, they're very concentrated towards the center, as you might expect. And my last diagram is a little confused or busy, and I apologize, but it's relatively important, so let me just take a minute to go through it. So these are the clusters. Okay, obviously, metallicity versus central density for clusters, taken from the Harris catalog. The open symbols, well, the filled symbols are core collapsed clusters, or possibly core collapsed clusters, according to the catalog. The small symbols, like all the circles, are the clusters we have searched at Parkes. And then, in addition, we have searched the six or seven triangles where we have actually found pulsars. So what you see here is that if you just consider our Parkes searches, we have searched something like 45 clusters. We found pulsars in six of them. Five of those are core collapse clusters, and all of them are very high-density clusters. So if you only knew that, you might have said, well, low-density clusters don't have pulsars. What's the problem? But then these other large symbols, the squares, are other clusters where pulsars are known to exist, usually from searches at Arecibo or Green Bank or Jodl Bank. And so in fact, well, I think the main conclusion to take from this so far, especially once you consider the selection effects, which have not been taken into account, is that just about any clusters in any point on this diagram can have pulsars. And the last bullet point here, which I think is important, is that the most luminous pulsar in each globular cluster, I sort of figured this out yesterday, has a luminosity within a factor of 2 of 12 millijansky kiloparsec squared. So think of 10 millijansky kiloparsec squared as sort of the most luminous pulsars within a factor of 2 in each cluster. But at parks, often, that is roughly our luminosity limit of our searches. So we are either, you know, if we're lucky, we find the top 1, 2, 3 pulsars in a cluster. And if we're unlucky, we don't find any. But they may well, very well, be there. It's just we're not really sensitive enough at parks. And so this is a good place to stop, because the next talks will talk about pulsar discoveries at Arecibo and the Green Bank telescope, which are intrinsically more sensitive telescopes. And so that's where you have to go if you want to probe the low end of the luminosity limit and try to learn something global. Anyway, I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, questions, comments? Fred? Wait for the microphone, please.
These six binaries in, what was it, 62, 66, do we know anything about them, positions in the cluster orbits, companions?
The positions are, we have timing positions for the three we found at parks, and they're in the center of the cluster within a couple of core radii. I mean, I have the number somewhere. And then the other three have been discovered at Green Bank, and Brian is working on that. You mean the binary periods and so on? I don't know the ones of Brian's that's here, so these are right. So actually you can see, well, there's a white dwarf with this kind of mass, and these two aren't clear what kind of systems they are. The couple, you know, fraction of a day, 4 days and a few hour orbits.
Yeah. Central density of these clusters is quite extreme.
That's right, it's very high. Yep.
Yeah, over there.
The scintillation that determines whether you can observe things or not, is that mostly in the cluster or in the galactic disk? And if the latter...
That's the galactic disk.
So then do you have much of a selection effect actually with, in terms of sort of galactic latitude as to which clusters you can search?
Yeah, a bit in latitude, but in the end, it turns out, roughly speaking, it's the dispersion measure, so just totally integrated column density. So, I mean, if you're searching a cluster along the plane that's really nearby, you might have similar scintillation characteristics to one that's slightly, I know, at a higher latitude but further away, that will have the same integrated column density of electrons. That's really what, first order, what matters.
So these two very puzzling, apparently high magnetic field pulsars on the outskirts of two clusters, I forgot which ones, has the association of any of those two with the cluster been clearly confirmed, say, by proper motion? What's the status of those two? Because that's, if it were confirmed that you can have a apparently young high magnetic field pulsar really in a global cluster, then that would really change everything.
Yeah, well, those, I would say, we definitely believe the association of those two slow pulsars with high magnetic fields. We believe they're associated with their parent clusters. Those are these two slow pulsars out here, and they're young. That is their characteristic age, p over p dot, is small. They are, let's see, what? Oh yeah, right, as I mentioned there, that they reside in dense globular clusters. There used to be three or possibly even four slow pulsars associated with clusters, and two of those have been shown not to be associated at all. But these two are, yeah, pretty clear. Well, in one case, there's a There's a cluster that has two known pulsars. One of them is a millisecond pulsar. Another one is one of these slow pulsars. And they have the same dispersion measure, and they are both near the center, and that's very clear. The other case, I guess it's just a matter, it's just very near the center, and that's the argument.
Well, related to that, I remember several years ago I plotted the pulsar spin periods versus a globular cluster central density, and it was kind of weird in the sense that they tended to go down as you went up in density, but then when you reached the very highest densities, which I think were dominated by M15, the actual spin periods tended to be longer. Have you looked at that with sort of your expanded sample now?
Well, so here in this plot, there's M15 down there, and there's 47 tuck, which admittedly is a factor of a few less in density, and of course 47 tuck has just millisecond pulsars, and M15 has this mixed bag of anything from millisecond all the way to kind of slow. The answer is no. I'm not sure we can say anything sensible about that so far. I mean, I know Schriekel, Karn, and Stuart Anderson 6 years ago or so wrote a review where they were trying to correlate incidence of isolated pulses versus binary pulses with cluster properties. And if you go and read their review, basically all they said in that regard is not really shown to hold anymore, just as you find more of these pulsars. So, yeah, I can't say anything.
Right. Well, if you had a summary slide which you didn't show, you'd have 2 minutes to do that, but maybe you don't have.
No, I don't have a summary slide.
No problem, then we'll go on to the next video.
Okay.